Hey everyone, Tom Salami here. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. I had a great time at JP Morgan. Thanks to everyone who said hello and answered my dumb questions. Look forward to asking more dumb questions through 2026. I'd like you all to join us on February 3rd, 4th, and 5th as part of our Device Talks Cardiac Innovations Week. This is one of our Device Talks Tuesdays virtual series. We'll be talking with three great companies in the cardiac innovation space: Syncardia, Field Medical, and Valcare Medical. Each of them have very different approaches to treating people with sick hearts, and very happy to have them as part of our week. You can join us live, and you can ask questions of your own. Kayleen Brown and or I will be leading those discussions, or you can watch on demand when it's convenient for you. So go to devicetalks.com to find out more information about Cardiac Innovations Week. Registration is also open for Device Talks Minnesota and Device Talks Boston. We've got great keynotes lined up for both. You can find them at devicetalks.com, or if you want to go directly to minnesota.devicetalks.com for the Minnesota site and boston.devicetalks.com for the Boston site. Very easy to find both. All right, folks, without any further delay, let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Neumacher, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. Finally, trash pickup the other day was the last chance to get the Christmas tree out, so finally got the Christmas
TMI,
tree out.
Chris Neumacher. I think we don't we didn't clear this in the morning notes about the podcast. What are we gonna talk about first? The trash pickup. I just visited the biggest medtech healthcare event of the year, and you start up a trash pickup.
Yeah. I hauled out a lot of garbage.
I'm really happy to hear it.
And there's the
anyway, I was at JP Morgan while you were hauling out garbage. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Let's talk about that. Yeah, we don't need to talk about it.
JP Morgan. Oh, yeah, that must have been nice, too. So JP Morgan was great, as always. I'm tired this morning, man. It's like I got in late last night. Like,
oh, man.
It's just like there are some moments where you're like looking at your socks and wondering, do I really need to put on socks today? Like, I don't want to put the effort into putting on these socks. Maybe I'll just go sockless, but it's 20 degrees or so. So I put on the socks. But great event. Just a great meetings, lots of meetings with very interesting, fascinating companies. People have a Device Talks Boston. Met a lot of great folks at MedTech Innovators Innovator Reception on Monday. Great overall event. And thanks to the fine folks at Isono Health for having me at their Next Horizon Summit, which was on Wednesday night. I got to MC that. Had Scott Gottlieb and others speaking and presenting. So it was a great week, and a big news week, Kristen Marker. Tons of
absolutely
news.
And I mean, and you know, we were covering a lot of the news out of JPM from afar, but a number of our newsmakers are based off news that came out of that that conference. So I mean, I mean, I could feel the buzz all the way from Minneapolis, like, you know, what was going on in San Francisco. So it was fantastic.
Well, I mean, it's no surprise that one of them is going to be Boston Scientific's acquisition of Penumbra. I don't think I'm spoiling anything, but it was just...
What? Wait, what? Oh my gosh, $14 billion? No way. What?
It was interesting to me that it came out on Thursday. I'm like, I wonder why... I'm just in my head, like, because typically you drop that bomb on Monday and that would be like all that anyone would talk about all week.
Yeah, I was wondering the
Thursday.
Same thing.
So you're like, was it strategic? Did they want to kind of mix the formula up a bit, or did the papers just not get signed until... I'm guessing it's the latter. I don't think it was, we need to announce this on Thursday and not Monday, because that's 3 days of holding something big like that.
Was Mahoney having one more? I mean, I'm totally don't know anything, but was Mahoney maybe having a last minute meeting at the conference, perhaps, to, you know, before they sealed the deal?
Finally, I don't know. I don't know. Obviously, I'm not an investment banker. I imagine everything was in line. They were just dotting I's and crossing T's. Is that right? Yes. Dotting I's and crossing T's.
Dotting I's and crossing T's. And yeah, having it out on Thursday was like that, like mic drop right at the end of the
But it was, yeah. But it, you know what? It was good timing. Like you're kind of like, oh, yeah. it's been quiet. And then like, boom, it really just kind of as people were leaving. So anyway, we'll get into
that. And I have more big news from Boston Scientific today that we will get to as well.
They're really setting the tone for sure. They did a couple of years ago with the Axonix acquisition. And they had another acquisition. I don't want to get a newsmaker. All right.
Yeah.
Let's get into the news. There's too much to talk about. Let's get into it.
Newmarker's newsmaker, right? They don't need to hear us just chatting around. Let's get into the news.
Anything else people need to know about your trash pickup? People, you good?
I'm good, Tom. Yeah. This was the last chance, I think, for people to leave their Christmas trees out. That was what I was
Hope people listening to this podcast have put their trees out so they're not realizing that they missed their opportunity.
Yes, the Newmarker Christmas tree's outside. The house is un-Christmased now. So we're in the new year. Off we go. And all this news.
That always feels good. It does.
So. But number five on the list, we've got Distal Motion. They secured funding from Johnson & Johnson that's going to support the rollout of their Dexter surgical robotic system in the ambulatory surgery centers.
Yeah, I posted about this on LinkedIn. I love J&J using its financial might to kind of place a lot of bets and get a lot and collect a lot of intelligence on the surgical robotics market. I mean, clearly, Dexter is not going to conflict with Ottava. And it does give J&J sort of insights in the market. They did their deal with Renovo, which is a larger kind of modular surgical, larger hospital, hospital-focused surgical robotic system. Again, Distal Motion is more ASC-focused. So they're really hedging their bets, I think. And as Tim Schmidt said at Device Talks West, you know, we're learners. We're doing this to learn. So great move
fantastic.
By JJDC.
Yeah. And ASCs are just like this really fast growing sector of healthcare and not really where you see a lot of really see Da Vinci robots. I mean, they're more of a hospital thing because they just have such a large footprint. So, you know, maybe with Ottava, you know, Johnson & Johnson's taking Intuitive more like head on, but this is like a nice play to kind of like, you know, like grow potentially in a peripheral area, or at least learn how to grow, like, you know, through this investment and Distal Motion. So, interesting story.
Yeah, definitely things are starting to formulate on the surgical robotics market. So great number five. Let's move on to
super exciting space.
Yeah. Number four. That could have been a number one any week. And I think I'm going to say that every episode.
Yes. I mean, we have so many stories.
Item. Yeah.
There's so much going on right now. This one could have been a number one in a particular week. We had Edwards Life Sciences. I mean, they've given up on the $1.2 billion Genevalve acquisition, especially because the FTC had a legal win in which a federal judge in D.C. Granted preliminary injunction. And that seems to have been the moment where Edwards decided to give up the fight for this deal. You know, the FTC saying that there could be antitrust concerns in the TAVR space if Edwards acquired Genevalve. But I mean, my big question now is what's next?
What's
going to happen next? I've seen some interesting speculation on LinkedIn, including from MedTech Domus, Joe Mullings, Jostradamus, sorry. Jostradamus had a whole business plan for somebody to potentially acquire. This is why you should acquire Genevalve. I was like, this is great.
Joe's already got it all mapped out. No, and Genevalve has put it out there that they're for sale. And you'd have to think that all these other companies that saw the Edwards acquisition saw why it was happening and realized, oh, maybe we should have done that. And now they can. Now they have their second chance. So, I suspect
if it was the one that got away. They've got the chance now, and also kind of interesting. Like, is now since Edwards couldn't acquire Genevalve, are they going to make a play somewhere else, like acquire somebody else who's got something innovative that, you know, maybe not as worrisome for the FTC? You know? So yeah, we'll keep on following this. I don't think this is the end of this story.
I am not an attorney in any means, and I don't understand these issues at all. But you know, how does Edwards move forward, knowing that any sizable acquisition could bring in this sort of regulatory scrutiny? I'm guessing they're kind of going back to, or have already gone back to the drawing board a bit and sort of trying to figure out, well, what is this too big a deal? Like, Do we only do small tuck-ins now? Right. Maybe one of our listeners has a sense of what the what's and why's, and they want to comment on our LinkedIn post.
If you're going to do a big deal, do you maybe acquire something else minimally invasive that complements your portfolio in some way?
Yeah. Do you move away from TAVR into a completely different area instead and build up that? So I don't know. Interesting time.
Couldn't
have been a number one any other week.
This is an awesome time to be covering med tech.
Let's see. The first article was by Sean Hooley. Number four was by Sean Hooley. Number three, Chris Neumarker.
Well, number three is by a freelancer that we've brought on to help us on Mass Device this week, Skylar Rivera.
Cool.
Skylar, yeah, exactly. She's based outside Los Angeles. And this was just a really, really good story that Skylar wrote off of Intuitive's JP Morgan talk from afar. It was really interesting that, they had preliminary results at the same time. I mean, they were saying that, they're exceeded 2025 expectations, looking at a 21% increase in revenue over the past year. That's just mind-boggling. And a lot of this is driven by their next-gen Da Vinci 5 robot. But I loved how Skylar kind of zeroed in on how CEO Dave Rosa, that was like his real excitement seems to have been talking about the Ion robotic, bronchoscopy system, and like what they could do with that.
Ion is very cool. Yeah. It's funny reading Skylar's article now. I see it was a bit jarring for me to read Intuitive CEO Dave Rosa. Like, I just was waiting to see Gary Guthart. And I know Dave Rosa has been CEO for a while, but like this, I think this is the first time I've read Intuitive CEO Dave Rosa. So it was interesting to see. The Ion is a fascinating piece of architecture. And between that and Monarch and Noah Surgical. The lung space is just getting such a great deal of attention. I think it's really critical that it does. I mean, this is something that needs to be, it's obviously a critical part of our bodies.
And Rosa said it straight up. He said the North Star that we have with Ion is to improve survivability of lung cancer. Right now it's used for biopsies, but it could be used for more perhaps you can get in there and ablate this cancer after you find it. So very exciting.
All right, Chris Neumarker. You got another young buck writing number two in the Neumarker's Newsmakers.
Oh, yeah. I think this person is really going to go far. Chris Neumarker. Chris Neumarker person.
That joke never gets old, right, folks?
That's right. I'm the cub editor, cub reporter here on this team. I checked out Medtronic's JPM talk from R, and the big news that stuck out to me in that talk was Medtronic saying it's really ready to go shopping again, really ready to step up its tuck-in M&A. The company's CFO even saying that they have significant firepower to boost their M&A. So, I mean, that's just good news for a lot of young medical device companies, that the world's largest med tech is going to be shopping.
That's great news. Yeah, no, and folks have been waiting and wanting Medtronic to get back into the game a bit more with M&A. So I was definitely happy to read that, especially this week at JP Morgan, which was pretty quiet until the aforementioned Penumbra deal. But even the Penumbra deal, it's more of a merger of giants as opposed to a really kind of Axonics morale boosting acquisition. Even that was publicly traded too, but that was a smaller company. But you know what I mean? People want to see big companies buy small companies. So, Medtronic's news definitely resonated throughout the cocktail receptions at JP Morgan.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so many big medical device companies out there. And, we have seen an uptick in IPOs, but, I mean, for many growing medtech companies, that's their exit. They're going to get acquired by somebody. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is really good news for those types of companies. And it's going to be, it's going to be exciting to see who Medtronic acquires. Yeah.
Definitely. All right. Let's roll into this massive number one. We've got multi-part
massive
number one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just a ton of Boston Scientific news this week. Just to start out, the Boston Scientific winning an FDA approval for its Farapulse pulsed field ablation catheter that goes with its extremely popular Farapulse PFA system. So that's a big win for them. I mean, a lot of weeks that might have been the top news, but not this week. Next up, we got news this week that Boston Scientific plans to acquire Valencia Technologies for undisclosed amount. I mean, this looks like a tuck-in acquisition, but they've got solutions for treating bladder dysfunction. So more big news then. But then you had not one acquisition this week, but two, and the two is just a whopper. Boston Scientific, planning to spend more than $14 billion to acquire Penumbra.
No, huge deal. Just two companies that I really like, two CEOs that I really like, seem like a natural fit. And as a observer of the industry, I'm excited to see Boston Scientific kind of go up against Stryker, which ironically has Boston Scientific's old neurovascular program to battle for leadership in this space. As I said in my LinkedIn post, not like either of those companies wants to be number two. So it sure will be a competitive market, which I think is good for patients. I think it's good for investors. I think it's good for entrepreneurs when you have two hungry companies trying to build dominant practices in the neurovascular space. And once again, going back to the patient, we need more help with strokes. With treating people who have had strokes. So I think this is just fantastic news.
Yeah, it is fantastic news. And just really exciting to see. I mean, Boston Scientific has just been on a real spree, really growing the company, really just expanding their portfolio so much with all these goals they have to kind of disrupt the whole surgery space with all these minimally invasive procedures. So, I mean, like, just really awesome to see them making this next acquisition. But then, just today, Tom, I had an article today. There was a little old planning commission meeting.
We got to go, Chris. Sorry, let's wrap up the new.
It's just a planning commission story, Tom. That's all it is. It's just a planning commission story.
Like, go ahead.
The Maple Grove, Minnesota Planning Commission, where Boston Scientific is now the Battlestar Galactica of a facility that they recently opened in Maple Grove, Minnesota, like 400,000 square feet. They now want to nearly double it. They want to add another 300,000 square feet to this. So just going to be a massive Boston Scientific presence along Interstate 94, in the northwest part of the Twin Cities metro. Not too far from Medtronic headquarters either.
First of all, I believe it was an Imperial Star Destroyer, not a Battlestar Galactica that we compared it to. But let's not go down too deep down that rabbit hole.
What about Babylon 5?
I've never been a big Babylon 5.
No. It was like the United Nations of Space. But anyway, go on, John.
as long as the name Boston is on the sign of that big building, then I'll take it. So
here you go. But yeah.
Good. Boston Scientific's going to have to put all these businesses somewhere, I guess, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, like, have I mentioned that Boston Scientific has more employees around
you've
Twin Cities than Boston?
All right, Chris Newmarker.
Yeah, it's a good I have to say, Boston had a big win with Transmedics. They're going to be like expanding into a huge new headquarters near the city in Boston. So like, there you go. Boston got a good win, and now Minnesota has a good win. So that's good. It's a rising tide lifts all ships.
All the med tech ships are rising, and that's all we're trying to figure at Device Talk. So, all right, Chris Newmarker. Great stuff.
Great as always, man.
All right. Thanks, Chris Newmarker. Now it's time for our FOMO interview. I spoke with Dr. Steven Michelson. He's the founder of Field Medical. He also was the one of the founders of Farapulse, which, of course, is a pioneer in the pulsed field ablation space. You can find out a little bit more about where Field Medical is headed here in this interview, but I also invite you to join us on our Cardiac Innovations series. Steve and I will be talking on February 4th. You can check it out. It'll be a live conversation. Steve will give a presentation. You can also ask your questions if you're watching live. It will also be available on demand. So go to devicetalks.com to register for that. Once again, we've got three different episodes. We'll be speaking on February 3rd, 4th, and 5th. I'll have a conversation with Steve Michelson on February 4th. You can register for one. You can register for them all. You can watch them live. You can watch them on demand. All right. Now let's hear my conversation with Steve Michelson. We conducted this at Device Talks West. Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi. Welcome to the Future of MedTech Opportunities. I'm talking with, I think, one of the folks who's going to be shaping that future directly, Dr. Steve Michelson. He's Chief Technology Officer and founder of Field Medical, of course, founder of Farapulse as well. And we've talked about, yeah, I think, PFA a great deal, but now we're talking about the ventricular side of the heart. And I hope, yeah, I just said that correctly, because as it came out, it didn't sound right. But you've now, you're at Field Medical. You're directing, I think, some of the lessons you learned from Farapulse to the ventricular side of the heart. What is particularly tricky or sort of undiscovered about that side of the heart?
Well, so the atria is relatively thin, mm-hmm, you know, and the big transformation that just happened is treating an arrhythmia called atrial fibrillation. And in order to do that, you create these therapeutic scars that are full thickness, in order to kind of shape the way the electricity moves in the heart. And it's been very successful. The atria doesn't move very much, and it's relatively smooth compared to the ventricle, which every time the heart contracts is moving a whole lot, mm-hmm, centimeters. And so, wow, getting stability there is hard. The ventricle is very complex internal geometry. It's not smooth. It has these things called trabeculation. And so it's got a complex shapes inside. And so it's really hard to, again, get stability or get to the right spot. And most importantly, the ventricle is really thick. And so to get a full thickness ablation when it's needed, that depth, almost no technology does it. And so, you know,
if you're diagnosed with something on the ventricular side of your heart, I'm sorry, but we really can't do, yeah, much to help.
Yeah.
So
open heart surgery used, okay, to be the drugs. Yeah. A couple of trials just came out that showed the drugs don't work very well. We kind of knew that.
Yeah.
But most people get is an ICD, an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, okay, that has, yeah, wires. It can sense when you go into a deadly arrhythmia in the ventricle and shock you out, but it doesn't prevent it from happening.
Okay.
And so catheter ablation has been done in the ventricle, but using tools that were really designed for the atria. Mm-hmm. And so these procedures take 4 hours or longer, and success is good, much better than drugs, but you know, it's a complex procedure. And generally, people who get ablation have to go to referral centers where people are willing to take the time. It's very much like AFib ablation was a decade ago.
Okay.
So I saw that as the frontier, and Field Medical has been focused there. And it, 3 years after founding the company, we finally got our first publication showing the how well a built for purpose technology can work in that environment.
So what we're talking about this at a Device Talks West, or mid October. You just announced the results, I think Friday.
Yes.
Last week. Talk a bit about the results. What did they show? Why you guys were really, really psyched about it?
Very exciting. Well, first of all, this is, you know, there's a lot of people working in the atria now with pulse field, but you know, this is the first real publication of a prospective trial of a technology in the ventricle. So it was picked up by Circulation, Vivek Reddy, and all the physicians who were involved in that, who are very proud that we were able to show a 98% reduction in VT burden. So if you have an ICD, prior to getting the ablation, we would count how many times you're having these deadly arrhythmias and getting therapy. And then after the ablation, how many arrhythmias we were having. And it was a dramatic drop.
That's huge.
Number two, just freedom from any VT altogether was an 82% success rate, which is dramatic and it's very good to see. Small sample, mm-hmm, very exciting results, 6 month results. So all the caveats need to be there. But, you know, this is really one of the most important studies, I think, you know, showing the next step forward where we can really reduce the period of time that it takes to do a VT ablation from 4 hours, maybe to an hour,
wow,
and turn it into a safer procedure for people who are otherwise very sick.
And does it also enable interventionalists who were previously able to do that procedure to be able to do that procedure? Is it less
Yeah.
Tricky. Let's.
Well, the energy, you know, so, you know, there's three steps what an EP doctor does. They diagnose, figure out where the problem is, where the circuit is, or where it's coming from. So, they map it, they diagnose it. Then they localize it and navigate to it with technology. You know, minimally invasively, we do catheters. We put the catheter next to the problem, and then we deliver energy. Mm-hmm. And in the past, the delivery of energy has been super problematic. Just not effective. And so you spend a lot of time in the chamber trying to get effective energy delivery. And now that I think we have successfully found a way to take that step and really compress it. And so, yes, I see a future where we can have general electrophysiologists who currently know how to use focal catheters, which is all of them, mm-hmm. will start routinely offering VT ablation.
And you were saying prior to our recording that with FARAPULSE, I feel like it took you had a head start. You had a lot of companies followed behind, and now we have a lot of offerings in PFA. Sounds like on the ventricular side, the competition, quote unquote, is lining up a little more quickly. Others are showing interest in the space.
Yeah.
Who is that? And do you see that as a positive? I would have to think it's a positive.
As a doctor, it's an incredible positive.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this means that we're not the only people trying to solve this problem.
Yeah.
As a businessman, it's, it's, you know, other than the frustration of, like, this was my blue ocean, and now people are like, jumped in the pool.
That's right. Got all these fish.
The reality is it also supports the business proposition, which is there is value. That is a growth opportunity in the ventricle, and we are all going after it. Mm. And so it's not a small market. It's half the size of AFib. But it's a very significant market with growth opportunity. And so I think we're not alone anymore. We got Medtronic coming after us. We got Boston doing trials in the ventricle now. And we got Abbott doing trials in the ventricle. Maybe Johnson & Johnson, but I know a little bit about some of the tools they're playing with. None of them are as good as ours, obviously. None of them.
Fantastic. Well, this sounds like a bright future for medical.
Yeah.
So, MedTech. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much.
All right.
All right, once again, go to devicetalks.com if you want to find out more about Field Medical and ask questions of your own. Now it is time for our keynote conversation. I had a chance to speak with Rob Binney. He's the CEO of Sheratronics, and we'll talk about how neuro energy is being used, or neurostimulation is being used, to help people who suffer from crippling migraines. Let's listen. Well, Rob Binney, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom. Great to be here. And thank you for taking the time and allowing us to tell our story a little bit more.
Oh, my pleasure. No, this is an important area. Migraine is something I fortunately have not had to experience, but I have great sympathies for those who do and love to see MedTech step up and try to solve a real problem for folks. Before we get into that that potential solution, though, we'd love to learn about your path into MedTech. You have a distinguished med tech career, but it looks like from your LinkedIn profile, you had a misstep early on. You went into pharma first. Was that, was that your path into life sciences?
Indeed it was. And candidly, coming out of college, I was a typical 24-year-old, like, what am I going to do with my life? We were going through coming out of a recession back in those days.
Yep.
And I remember in a very elementary way going, I need to be involved with an industry that is recession proof.
That's
very smart.
I landed
in healthcare. I was like, you know, the generations are getting older. There's going to be a need for healthcare. And that's where I ended up making the choice to join a pharmaceutical company back in the 90s.
And then you turn to the light side and join Boston Scientific. How'd you make that transition to MedTech?
Yeah, interestingly, I was on the pharmaceutical career path for the better part of the 90s, and I actually, believe it or not, went through three mergers during that time span of around 6 years. Remember, it was in the 90s; it was a lot of M&A activity going on. And one of my dear friends ended up leaving my team, actually, and joined Boston Scientific, and just, you know, had been talking to me a little bit about the speed with which, you know, technology was transforming patient outcomes, innovation was happening at a much more rapid clip. And I just became enamored with the potential for medical technology in the treatment of patients and improvement of outcomes. And that's how I ultimately followed him into Boston Sci. And that began my medical technology career.
How do you compare and contrast the sales of pharma versus medical devices? Is it the same storyline, very different?
Very different. You know, when I think about the business models associated with pharma from a commercial standpoint, and again, remember my experience is dated, it takes me back to the 90s, but, you know, that experience, that business model was very focused on, you know, this idea of repetition. So being out in front of providers with regularity and providing them with, you know, similar sort of messages and, mm-hmm. you know, features, benefits. And again, it wasn't as what I would call kind of value selling per se, which is where I believe, you know, MedTech really differentiates itself, whereby your presence, hopefully if you're doing your job right, is value creating, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that's your ability to, you know, support cases or help in the partnering of you know, doing direct-to-patient types of initiatives or practice building, et cetera. There's just a number of different opportunities to bring value. And I found that to be very refreshing with MedTech, in addition to the fact that the way that your performance is rewarded in MedTech is a lot different than it is in pharmaceuticals. You know, your results are very tangible, and yep. And you're rewarded for them, and subsequently, you know, your performance managed for not performing. And I thrive in that environment.
That's an interesting point. It's one I've heard of recently, the last couple of weeks. So it certainly holds up. And it's a great point about pharma too. Like pharma, you're selling a pill, but you're basically just putting another quarter in an existing machine, where MedTech, you're really saying, no, the machine could work better if you did this or if you use that.
And the pace and the speed with which, you know, you are introducing new products, new therapies, et cetera, in MedTech is just, it's a different, whole different cadence than you experience in pharma.
We're glad you found your way over here. You moved over to Access Closure, and then spent time at Intersect ENT, where you were chief commercial officer the last couple of years, working up through sales. That's a great company, great med tech company. How did you come to find your way to Intersect ENT?
Yeah, so I actually spent, I guess it was around 4.5 years at Access Closure. One of my mentors is to this day is Leslie Trigg and Fred Kashravi. And
two great ones.
They were really helped me cut my teeth with regard to the sort of Silicon Valley med tech startup experience. Coming from Boston, it was new. It's a new language. You talk about pace. It's a whole new pace. You know, a chance to really stretch your skill sets. Actually I ended up meeting, Lisa Earnhardt, another mentor of mine, who's now obviously at Abbott, through Leslie, when my time was coming to a close at Access Closure, and, spent time, while I was still at Access Closure, visiting with Lisa, hearing her vision for Intersect ENT, and, just felt like there was a real match there. Not only because I think Lisa's a phenomenal leader, but, was really impressed by the differentiation, you know, that, Intersect had as it relates to the clinical data and clinical evidence. I loved Lisa's leadership and the team she had put together, and I just saw a real opportunity to build, a world-renowned team and put together a great growth story of which in retrospect that, you know, sometimes the intuition's right. And I think it was in my case when I chose Intersect.
That's great. You just mentioned three of my favorite folks in MedTech, really amazing leaders. And I wonder at this point, when you're at Intersect ENT, again, your chief commercial officer in 2019, did you see yourself as a CEO? Leslie would move on outset. Lisa would move on to Abbott. Fred Kasravi, of course, is now an Apparitive and had been at Access Closure. Yeah. Did you have that bug at that point?
You know, it's funny, and it all will come full circle to my mentors. You know, when I was, I had been getting a number of different opportunities come across my desk. You know, Intersect was on everybody's radar. We'd had a successful IPO. We built a around $120 million annual, you know, revenue line. Built a you know, again, a best-in-class med tech team. And so opportunities naturally were coming across my desk. And I didn't give it a lot of thought as it relates to your point, the president and CEO role, until such time as Lydia came across my desk. And I actually, you know, because I try not to make impulsive decisions. I actually went to Leslie, I went to Lisa, and I shared with them the opportunity and why I was, you know, intrigued by the Alidia opportunity. And I remember having dinner actually at the Stanford Park Hotel with Leslie, and she said, "Well, why do you want to be a CEO?" And it was the first time anyone had asked me that. And I reflected on my experience at Intersect, Access Closure, and I realized that the thing that got me up in the morning was the ability to have influence and the ability to lead people. And I really enjoyed it in my highest points in my career was when I was, for instance, a field sales trainer, or when I was a sales director, where people would reach out and ask for advice and would ideate, seek an opportunity to ideate together on solutions. So there was problem and there was solution. I love that aspect of leadership is being able to tackle, you know, challenging problems with really talented individuals on your team. And that was really sort of the first moment when I was like, you know, I think at a broader scale, I could have, you know, some impact and bring some value to an organization. On top of that, Lisa had done a remarkable job of bringing me into the fold, as she did with all of her senior leaders, and helping us as we built Intersect to, you know, ensure there was visibility across all functions of the organization. So I really got a great bird's eye view of how and appreciation of how all the various functions of an organization work together to create, you know, success, if you will. And I think that was a real eye-opener for me, where I was able to get exposure to regulatory, to R&D, to quality, obviously market access, clinical, and I understood how all the pieces kind of work together to execute against a, you know, a master plan. And so those were sort of the key, I guess, enlightening moments for me that gave me the passion to pursue my first CEO gig at Alidia.
How much of your learning from that exposure was you being curious and just sort of wanting to absorb more? And how much was it, do you think, by design, Lisa's or otherwise, to grow and mature and give experiences to the team? Is it a little bit of both, or what do you think?
I would say it's definitely a combination. You know, I think some of it early on at Access, I didn't know what I didn't know. You know, I was still earlier in my med tech startup career, but getting exposure to people like Leslie, you know, Mike McKinnon, you know, Fred Kishravi, you know, I think by osmosis, I was absorbing a lot. But then as I approached Intersect ENT, I found Lisa to be very intentional in putting me in positions where I could really continue to spread my wings and develop skill sets that have been very applicable in my last job and my one today.
So just circling in on Alidia, do you remember the moment when you said, "I'm going to do it"? And what was the switch that was flipped that caused you to make that decision?
Yeah, I remember very vividly when I really made my decision that this was the right opportunity for me. And it's probably not as crisp of a revelation that you might expect, because Alidia at the time had just come through their pivotal study, and it was a really challenging study to complete. But they were also running out of money. And then, as it were, COVID was approaching. And at this time I was kind of like, all right, I'm gonna have to immediately get in. I'm gonna have to go fundraise and raise at least a bridge round for, you know, us to get to commercial. Never done any fundraising before. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great first CEO gig. I'll do it. but as it were, I knew that I had a number of talented, you know, advisors, mentors that were there urging me on. And subsequently, I assessed that, you know, there was nothing that was really broken there. It was just going to be a matter of building a few new muscles and getting out there and problem solving. And you know, the net is, you know, those were sort of the external factors that I was navigating and weighing. But at the end of the day, when I looked at the opportunity to apply a very innovative design in a space that, you know, historically had only pharmacologic or relatively, you know, few medical, you know, intervention types of approaches. Mm-hmm. They were most of these patients with postpartum hemorrhage, you know, were treated pharmacologically. And I noted that there was no real innovation in labor and delivery at the time. And then I looked at the data that we had, and I saw that we had a real opportunity to introduce a game-changing technology, and most importantly, when you tie it to mission, to save moms' lives. And when Amazing. I look at it in retrospect, it was the best decision I could have ever made. It was such a gratifying, you know, journey in terms of the ability again to keep families intact. To save moms. And when you, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at sort of your life's work, you hope that you've had impacts. And, you know, from my vantage point, that was the biggest driver, was the ability to have a real impact on preserving families, keeping moms alive. And as I look back on it now, you know, we saved a lot of moms' lives. It was really, fantastic. Really awesome and gratifying experience.
And just a quick, what to tell us quickly about Jada, the product that Alydia.
Yeah. So I give the early team a lot of credit. They identified that, you know, one of the root causes of postpartum hemorrhage and the rising rates of postpartum hemorrhage in the United States, let alone the developing world, happened to tie back to, you know, the atonic uterus, if you will. And what that means is the uterus will become fatigued over time with a number of factors, comorbidities like hypertension, you know, diabetes, et cetera, and also multiple births. It essentially gets fatigued. And, you know, the ability for the uterus post delivery to contract is essential in essentially telling the body to shut down, you know, the passage of blood to the uterus. And one of the things that was happening, you know, was that many of these patients that were experiencing abnormal uterine bleeding or postpartum hemorrhage had this experience, right, where they just had a, you know, atonic uterus. It was not contracting, therefore blood continued to flow, and led to, again, you know, large rates of blood loss. And the challenge was that the pharmacologic options, while they are effective, it's very difficult to predict who's going to be a non-responder. Mm. And so, again, back to the early engineering team, you know, they identified this opportunity, this need, whereby if you could introduce a suction device into the uterus and essentially start to help facilitate the contraction of the uterine walls, that in fact, it's almost like lifting doing a curl, of which I don't do a lot, but when you do a curl, the early part of it is hard, but once you get past that 90 degree part, you know, it gets much easier. And that's what you're really trying to accomplish with the Jada device, is start to facilitate the contraction of the uterus. And as I believe, you know, the data was very compelling. We were seeing bleeding cessation within approximately 3 minutes in our early data, and that became very compelling.
And you sold the company, or the company was acquired by Organon. Thank you, Organon. So successful outcome, and only 1 year after taking over as CEO. Spending a lot of time in your career, I want to move on to Sharetronics in a moment, but I do have one final career question, because I'm looking at LinkedIn. You became CEO July 2020, so things were already past smoldering at that point. The world was an uncertain place. Some could say that's a dumb time to take a CEO job because you don't know what's going on. Others could say it's a brilliant time to take a CEO job because you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't know what the world would look like, so I don't think anyone would hold you responsible for a negative outcome. So with those two voices talking to you in either ear, and did you just I have this in mind because I just edited my conversation with Tim Schmidt of Johnson & Johnson, and his advice was just always say yes when you're presented with an opportunity. Was this a situation of you just saying yes, that this was an opportunity that you really wanted to do?
It was really that. I just, again, back to the mission, and the innovation that addressed an unmet need, it was just a pull. I just felt like it was an opportunity to do some good, and to truly introduce, an innovative concept in the treatment of, a condition that had no real solutions, if you will. And then I was also intrigued by the fact that there was opportunity to build a lower cost device that could have an effect on women across the globe. And you think about, some of the developing nations of Africa, where they see, abnormal uterine bleeding and postpartum hemorrhage rates that can approach 30%. Real opportunity there outside of just the U.S. And so I was really compelled again and pulled by this, this opportunity to be able to leave an impact.
Fantastic. So let's move on to Sharetronics.
Yeah.
I've done probably close to over 400 episodes of podcasts over the last 5 years of various types. I honestly cannot recall another one that focused on migraine. And as I said at the top, migraine is a huge problem, but it's not something that you typically see MedTech applied to. So talk to me first a little bit about migraines. What is the market like? What are the challenges? And then we'll get into your hopeful solution.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll try to frame the migraine market for you by a couple of data points. So in the United States alone, there are approximately 40 million episodic migraineurs. So these are patients that struggle with less than 15 headache days per month. And they experience various ranges of intensity. Headache can be one that, just kind of causes you to have a little bit of loss of productivity at work, but you're still able to go to work. And then there's the severe headaches, right, that really knock you out for a full day. Mm-hmm. And then there's another category of chronic migraineurs. These are patients that actually suffer with, if you can believe it, 15 or more headache days per month. And they need to have those symptoms for 3 consecutive months just to earn the diagnosis. Average duration of headaches, about 4 hours. So when you talk about, the level of debilitation, you think about it, every other day, you have a headache, which is, just an extraordinarily, lifestyle limiting, experience for these patients.
You don't know when it's coming. You don't know how it's going to hit you. But
if you go back to the pathogenesis, there's a number of theories about causes of migraines. What everybody has agreed to is that some trigger, stimulates this hyperexcitability within the head that ends up, you know, terminating in the release of these inflammatory mediators that cause head pain. And some will describe, you know, their, I call it stimuli, as being, you know, red wine or, you know, flashing lights. You know, there are other theories that there's a hormonal component to the triggering of migraines. But the net is some stimuli ends up taking these patients into a hyperexcitable state, which in turn leads to this release of these inflammatory mediators, and thus the headache begins.
And I open this by saying I haven't suffered from a migraine. Is this something, as your body changes, that you could go from a fortunate person who has zero to someone who's suffering from 15 or more events a month?
Yeah, so a good, really good question. So it typically tends to be a progressive condition.
Okay.
Oftentimes, patients will be diagnosed in their, you know, latter teens, early 20s, and many times they will earn the diagnosis of episodic, right, where they'll have 2, 3, you know, 6 per month. And then oftentimes without effective treatment, these patients will move to the diagnosis of chronic. So it typically, you know, is, to your point, it is a progression for many of these patients. And interestingly, I'll point out that there is also a progression as in the latter years of one's life, when you get over 50, you know, plus years old, sometimes patients actually experience a decrease in headaches.
Oh, interesting.
Which is interesting. But the net is in their prime of their lives, their highest productivity years, the years when they're building families and whatnot. That's typically when they're afflicted by migraine. Another interesting data point is approximately 2/3 of the population are premenopausal women. So it disproportionately affects women, again, in the prime of their lives.
Interesting. So talk to me about the way that the treatments that are available today and the clinical infrastructure that's works around and treats migraines. Who are the doctors that are helping patients with this, if there are any?
Yeah. So typically, these patients are managed, especially early on in their disease process. They're typically managed by primary care. But when the headaches get to a point of real lifestyle debilitation, they often are referred out to a neurologist.
Okay.
And a neurologist typically will manage these patients, especially the episodic patients. In the severe case, these patients, you know, will be then oftentimes referred out to a headache specialist, which is a branch of neurology, if you will. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, the neurologist really are managing the majority of these patients.
Okay. So, and is the, what are the treatments that they're offering currently? Is it pharmaceutical? Is it dark room? What are the options for patients right now?
Yeah. Another good question. So in terms of the treatment algorithm, oftentimes when patients have an episodic diagnosis, they will be treated with typically the triptans, the abortive medications. So meaning, you know, reactively, if I have a headache, I take one of these pills, and they typically, carry on with that form of treatment for a long time. More and more frequently, patients are actually getting access to the biologics, of which there are a number of them, and these are the obviously the systemic, you know, biologics that can be administered via shot form or, you know, a pill in the more recent iterations. And those patients, you know, typically, you know, are episodics, but then they often will bridge, you know, into chronic, you know, chronic patient, you know, treatment. Patients also at times are treated with Botox. There's some literature that suggests that, you know, by injecting patients in you know, select areas of the head, that you actually can give them relief. The literature suggests around a 2-2.5 day treatment effect size for those patients that take Botox shots as well. Challenge with that is you end up with a lot of different shots, approximately like 30 plus shots, you know, in one engagement in your head, which is a challenge. But it is an effective therapy for patients. And then there are some more invasive types of treatments, you know, such as nerve block, you know, nerve decompression type treatments. They're not as widely used. They're for more, you know, severe patients. And then there's also external neuromodulation systems that have attempted to be used for patients primarily that are episodic, not the treatment-resistant chronic migraine population that we're looking to serve.
Interesting. So let's learn about Sheratronic's approach. What's your device and how does it work?
Yeah. So I think what I should probably do is start by articulating the patients that we are focused on serving. So, you know, our sweet spot, our patient population is really the patient that has failed all conventional modalities. You know, they failed the triptans, they failed the CGRPs, they failed Botox, and they're still left with 15 or more headache days per month, and left with no real options. And to your point, the dark room, shutting down stimuli, locking yourself in a room and just trying to ride it out becomes their primary mode of therapy and treatment. At Sheratronic, actually have been the benefactors of our founders, Dr. Mudit Jain and Lynn Elliott, who had done some extensive interrogation, I'll call it, of some of the off-label experience of neuromodulation in treating head pain. And believe it or not, there is a long history of neuromodulation in the treatment of head pain that dates back, you know, 20 years. And in the last, say, 15 years, one of the available treatment modalities was actually the use of spinal cord stimulators, and whereby they would stick the can in the pectoral region and they would tunnel across the neckline all the way up to the target nerve. And at the time, the early work was done on the occipital nerve. And patients were actually getting some relief. And so much so that back in the 2010, 11, 12, 13 time frame, many of the big companies, Boston Scientific, Medtronic, St. Jude at the time, all commissioned their own RCTs. Again, using the spinal cord stimulator as their primary mode of stimulation. And again, at the time, they were going after the occipital nerve. And the interesting thing is that all three of those studies actually failed. They did not meet their primary endpoint. But there was, and this again goes back to the genius of Mudit and Lynn, who recognized that actually there were some really positive data in the early studies. And they also spent time talking to, some of the providers that were doing the off-label procedures. And they realized that something was working. And what I mean by that is actually, if you look at the secondary endpoint in the St. Jude study, which was mean reduction in monthly headache day, they actually achieved statistical significance. But as a primary endpoint, which was, you know, using a responder rate, they actually missed. And the interesting thing is what's happened over the last decade is actually the FDA's come around and agreed that the better measure of efficacy in treating head pain is mean reduction in monthly headache day, which is actually our primary endpoint. And that thankfully the, you know, CGRP companies, the, you know, Botox all got the FDA to agree that that was a better measure of efficacy. So I think, you know, again, to give you some historical context, the endpoints they were using in the early days were the wrong endpoints, which is encouraging for us. And again, our primary endpoint is mean reduction in monthly headache day. The other interesting evolution that has taken place is that You know, this off-label experience persisted over the last 10, 15 years. And what you find in some of the published literature of the off-label experience is that the incorporation of the supraorbital nerve in addition to the occipital nerve actually gives you a doubling of the responder rate, which is our approach. And so, you know, that's another key differentiator is that we're targeting the supraorbital and the occipital nerve with, mm-hmm. with a, you know, neuromodulation platform. And then the last point I'll make is that in the off-label experience, when they were sticking the can again in the pectoral region, they were tunneling across the neckline. The one confounding factor was there were really high rates of mechanical failure. So the leads were migrating. There would be some lead fracture at times. And it made sense because you were crossing this neckline with the lead, which the one appendage is moving all the time and applying torque on a lead, for instance, happens to be the head. And that behooved, you know, us to believe that a head-mounted system, one that's tucked in just in the subcutaneous tissue of the head, not in the cranium, just in the tissue. But we believe that would be a better form factor to be able to address some of the mechanical issues of the early experience. And I'm pleased to announce, again, knock on wood, but in our pilot study done in Australia, we actually at 1 year had a 0% rate of lead migration. So it tells us that, again, small sample size, but it tells us that the original theory that a head-located system, you know, targeting the supraorbital and the occipital nerves, you know, was the right way to go. And so hopefully that gives you a little bit of history of, you know, some of our early founder work and, you know, and also the history of Neuromod in treating head pain.
Sure. And looking at the device on your website, I mean, it looks like it's about the size of a car key fob, a security thing, but it's obviously slimmer and sleeker.
It was designed to be a discrete device, one that is imperceptible to the human eye. And so far, let's call it we've done roughly, let's call it 150-ish, implants. I can confidently tell you that it's virtually imperceptible to the human eye.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of effect is it having on patients? Do you have any?
Yeah, I can't speak to our pilot experience. It is obviously a blinded study, but I can speak to our pilot experience. But our pivotal is, again, it is a blind study. Mm-hmm. But in our pilot experience, we actually implanted 11 patients, and that was done in 4 centers in Australia. And we ended up at our primary endpoint of 12 weeks, essentially taking patients from around 19.8 headache days per month to approximately, 7 headache days per month. So a very significant drop in monthly headache day. And that is a very meaningful result. The other thing that we looked at was the ability of our therapy to affect the severity of headaches. And in our pilot work in Australia, we were able to take patients from roughly 8 severe headache days to approximately 2 severe headache days mm-hmm. Per month. And that's a really important point that I'll make, because when you talk to neurologists, they will tell you that the mean reduction in monthly headache day is important. It is critical. But it is the combination of mean reduction in monthly headache day plus reductions in the incidence of severe headache days that equals mm-hmm. restoration of functionality. So if you can reduce a number of headache days, reduce the number of severe headache days, you actually can give patients the ability to get back to their lives, even if they're having moderate headaches. That is the
cook dinner for the family or pick up the kids.
That's exactly right. And actually in our pilot study, we used the migraine specific quality of life scoring. And this is a validated scoring tool that is used in many of the headache studies. and it essentially evaluates, the improvements in levels of impairment across three domains, which is emotional outlook, your ability to essentially be present with your family and, you know, sort of your personal life, and then also the improvements in your outlook at work. And across all three domains, we saw stepwise improvements from, you know, baseline to 12 weeks, indicating that we were reducing levels of impairment for these patients and, again, helping them resume, you know, normal life, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I was going to ask about that as well, because on the Slack channel, you'll often see a coworker, you know, I need to go lie down, I've got a headache. So you see an impact on output. So going back to your original point about what you liked about MedTech, this is a product that's consistent with your thesis of bringing value, really changing the system. Assuming you go forward and find clinical success, how do you see this fitting into the clinical setting? Is this, obviously this is a procedure of sorts. I'm not sure if a neurologist or a form of neurologist does it. Who do you think would ultimately become the treating physicians?
Yeah, good question. So the interesting thing for us is that we're in a fortunate scenario in that, you know, the neurologist who's currently treating these patients today, as I mentioned, don't have a lot of great options. By the way, I didn't mention that there are about 3 million patients in the United States alone.
Really?
That are deemed treatment resistant, that are, you know, chronic migraine patients. They've tried and failed, you know, multiple modalities, and they're just not getting relief. And so it's a very sizable market. And again, back to the question, you know, these patients are being managed largely by the neurologist today, and they just don't have an option, you know, other than just continuing to give them biologics and systemic drugs and whatnot. So what we found in our pivotal study is there is a very high degree of willingness to refer these patients out. Refer them out to our implanting centers, and our implanters are going to be the neurosurgeons or the interventional pain physicians, at least as a primary focus in our early limited launch. Our pivotal study has approximately 60-40 split of neurosurgery and interventional pain physicians. So the procedure can be done by both specialties. From there, the implanting physicians really don't have a desire to manage these patients. So they're just simply sent, you know, back to the neurologist for ongoing care and maintenance and management. So we're really trying to create a little bit of an ecosystem with the patient at the center, neurology on one side, interventional pain or neurosurgery on the other. But again, everybody working together to treat these patients and improve their outcomes.
That's really interesting. And you had said coming to our centers, you mean your clinical centers, just you don't have a plan to build your own treatment centers?
No, good clarification. These are our clinical centers, of which there are approximately 27 of them in our pivotal study right now, four of which are in Australia and the rest in the United States.
Interesting. Are there larger entities out there, larger OEMs that are currently treating migraines in some form or fashion, or would this, you think, be sort of a novel market for MedTech?
I will say this. There's a lot of noise in the channel, and there are a number of different theories on how to treat. I'm a science guy and a data guy, of which, you know, at the modalities that I talked about earlier in terms of, you know, the pharmacologic interventions, the externals, the off-label experience, those are the ones that are really backed by, you know, quality science.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, final question. What kind of response are you getting from the patient community? What is the patient community like? Are they a community, or are they a bunch of 3 million people suffering individually? What is the patient population like?
A really good question, and I will point out that more so than most, patient populations that I've encountered, they are highly involved with their care. They know They know, you know, all the different modalities that have been tried on them. They are constantly on, you know, in social media channels and in chat rooms and in support groups trying to, you know, ideate on what's worked, what hasn't worked. They're very active in their care. And they're looking for solutions. And so, you know, one example is, there's a support group, called Migraine Buddy. I believe there's about 1.5 million patients that, subscribe and, you know, and this is how they're constantly getting notifications pushed on new modalities, new treatments. There's again, support group, you know, function there. In fact, our study was pushed to a number of patients out there just as a potential option. So, you know, again, to answer your question, they're just a highly engaged, very sophisticated, intelligent, you know, patient population that are looking for new solutions. You know, again, it's been, I guess the right word's not easy, but it's been fairly easy for us to access them, throughout our study.
Interesting. All right. Well, it's an important problem. It's a big problem. As I said, it's one I think we all encounter day to day working with folks who suffer from this. So, this sounds like an amazing opportunity for MedTech to make a difference. So Rob, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much. We have some work to do still. Obviously, got to get through through our pivotal study, I should say. But you know, the early encounters that we've had with patients, especially dating back to our pilot work, are very encouraging. You know, I'll give you one anecdote and then I'll let you go. But we have in our offices here a watercolor painting hanging up. I call it Hope. And the reason is one of our patients had previously been a painter 20 years prior to her migraine affliction. And after a trial course of our therapy, she actually was able to pick up the paintbrushes and resume painting.
Oh, amazing.
For the first time. And she painted a painting for one of our field clinical engineers whom she had developed a relationship with throughout the process of the study. And we hang it up there as a reminder that, you know, our therapy, again, which still has to be proven through science, but our therapy does, you know, represent an early opportunity to restore hope and to give patients their lives back. And that's what it's all about. You know, we only get one turn on this great planet of ours. And, you know, my hope is that I can end my career, hopefully, you know, doing meaningful things like this and really having an impact on patients. And I think at the end of the day, that's what we all want. We'll just have to see. And I appreciate the interest and the opportunity to tell our story, and we'll keep you posted along the way.
That's great. No, I'm glad you shared that, and it kind of circles back to our pharma versus medtech comparison. So yeah. I don't know if you may get that painting at a pharma company, but to have a medtech professional get to know a patient to that degree and be able to be given a gift like that is pretty amazing.
Indeed. Yep. Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate the time and the interest. And like I said, we'll keep you posted as we keep hitting milestones.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, I hope you register for our Cardiac Innovations series. It takes place February 3rd, 4th, and 5th. On February 3rd, we'll speak with the folks at Syncardia. February 4th, once again, I'll talk with Steve Michelson of Field Medical. And on February 5th, we'll visit with Valcare Medical, which is a company that's redefining structural heart repair. So three great companies tackling three huge issues. And Syncardia, of course, is a pioneer of total artificial heart technology. Field Medical is looking at ventricular cardiac arrhythmias. And Valcare, as I mentioned, is doing structural heart repair. So lots to learn there. I hope you'll be part of those conversations. Go to devicetalks.com to register. Also, Device Talks Minnesota and Device Talks Boston are open for registration. So we certainly hope to see you there as well. We'll begin adding to the agenda over the coming weeks. And we really would love to see you at Device Talks Minnesota on May 4th and at Device Talks Boston on May 27th and 28th. All right. Well, that's it, folks. Please do subscribe to the Device Talks Weekly podcast. You can now subscribe directly to that. Or, of course, as always, you can subscribe to the Device Talks podcast network so you're not miss any of our future MedTech podcasts. All right. That's a wrap, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly podcast.